Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adiskin. This is Financial Survival for Thursday, August 28th, year of our Lord, 2014. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. James Corbett will be our guest starting in the second and third segments of the program. First off, we'll get on with the market report, and then I'll follow up with some current news and commentary. Gold is up $6.90 per ounce to $1,290.60 per ounce. Silver is up 9 cents to $19.63 per ounce. Platinum is up 6 to $1,430. Palladium is up 6 to $899 per ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up, down 38 points to 17,084. NASDAQ is off 8 points to 4,562. New York Stock Exchange is down 22 points to 11,016. U.S. Dollar Index is flat. 82.46 for the U.S. Dollar Index. Crude oil is up 71 cents to $94.59 per barrel. That's got to be a little bit of good news for those who invest in crude oil. It's at least up out of the 93 range for the moment. We'll see how long that runs. Let's take a look at some of the interesting news. Here's something from the Associated Press. The headlines is U.S. Coast Guard fires at Iranian boat in the Gulf. Now, that's a little bit, it's the U.S. Coast Guard, so you might first think that they're firing at an Iranian boat in the Gulf of Mexico, but no, they're firing at an Iranian boat in the Persian Gulf, and it just raises an interesting point. What is the United States Coast Guard doing over in the Persian Gulf? I would assume that the mission for the United States Coast Guard is to protect the coast of the United States. If we're going to send some naval personnel over to some foreign country or the Persian Gulf or wherever, why not send the United States Navy? And of course they do. But it is a little bit strange. It strikes me as strange that the United States Coast Guard is operating in the Persian Gulf. What else have we got? Here's something. If you're looking for an assault rifle, now's a good time to buy one. There, at about the time President Barack Obama took office, buyers flocked to the stores in Lilburn, Georgia, to stock up because of concern that the federal lawmakers would tighten gun laws, a worry that only grew after the 2012 Connecticut school massacre. Now, with the political impetus waning for new restrictions, the rush for firearms is also ebbing. Assault rifle sales have stopped in their tracks, said Jim Hornsby, owner of the Suburban Atlanta store. He estimated the sales of long guns, rifles, are off 70% from last year. And he says it's hard to give an AR away. Well, that means prices are down, and if you're interested in buying, now's the time. You should be able to find rifles, really good deals on rifles, not just from the stores, but from the people who stocked up and bought them hand over fist back during the rush. And they didn't buy just one rifle. They might have bought a half a dozen. Right now they're wondering how they're going to make the payment on their bass boat. And they say, you know, I've got half a dozen rifles over there. Maybe it's time I sold one at a pretty good price. So it comes and it goes. And it's one of those things where everyone credited Obama with selling more firearms than any other living president, and he did. And now that no one's trying to take guns away, people don't care much about them anymore. They're not buying them the way they did in the past. And it's just a natural part of life, and yet it's kind of ironic. We have, when they're threatening to take the guns away, we buy millions of them. When they don't threaten to take them, we kind of leave them in the closet and don't mess with them. There's another headline from Bloomberg. Russian hackers said to loot gigabytes of big bank data. It's the headline. Russian hackers attacked J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and at least four other banks this month in a coordinated assault that resulted in the loss of gigabytes of customer data. At least one of the banks has linked the breach to Russian state-sponsored hackers, said one of the people. The FBI is investigating whether the attack could have been retaliation for the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia. What's the point of this story? They were able to rob four banks. They didn't get to just one. They were able to steal data from five banks, big banks, major banks. What's that tell us? It only confirms something we've talked about on the program from time to time in the past. There is no privacy in the digital age. If you have information and you're storing it in digital form and you think it's secure, you'd be dumb. All right? If you want to maintain some level of secrecy about your financial resources, how much money you have, or what your worth is, chances are it's not an ideal solution to store your wealth in a bank. It's not even ideal to store it on your own computer if you're hooked up to the internet. Because as soon as you let anyone access your computer besides you, you are opening yourself up to exposure. And if hackers can get gigabytes out of big banks, which should have fairly good security systems, they can certainly get information from you. Now, whether they want it or not, it's another story. Why do they, you know, it's like, if you wanted to hack into my computer, well, you could hack into it if you wanted to, but what would you find? I publish just about everything I write on the internet already. I don't really have any secrets in my computer. I don't do any internet banking. There are no secret passwords to bank accounts or whatever on the computer. There's not really much to get. Nevertheless, if you're going to assume there's privacy on your computer and you're tied into the internet or anything else in the digital world, you just can't count on that anymore. If you want privacy, you're going to have to stay in a medium that is not digital. And one of the implications of that, and I'm not saying this is a sales pitch, but as an implication, trying to take care of maintain a level of privacy and secrecy, with whatever wealth you have in the form of gold and silver. It's doable. It's not digital. It's not easily hacked into. The only one you have to worry about is you. If you can keep your mouth shut, then your secret is probably safe. On the other hand, if you want to tell everybody at the bar, got all your gold hidden behind a rock and built into the fireplace, your secret probably isn't all that safe. What else do we have? Here's the Russians. Ukraine reports Russian invasion on a new front. This is in the New York Times. Determined to preserve the pro-Russian result in eastern Ukraine, Russia reinforced what Western and Ukrainian officials described as a stealth invasion, sending armored troops across the border as Russia expanded the conflict to a new section of the Ukrainian territory. Latest incursions, which Russia's military said included, which Ukraine's military said included five armored personnel carriers, was at least the third movement of troops and weapons from Russia across the southeast part of the border with Ukraine this week, further blunting the momentum of Ukrainian forces that have made in weakening the insurgents in Donetsk and Luhansk and in the eastern part of Ukraine. Point. Initially, the rebels, the Ukrainian rebels, were kicking the buns of the Ukrainian military. The rebels were winning big time when they first started out. Then the Ukrainian government sent their frontline troops after the rebels and started pushing the rebels back, and it looked like the rebels were on the verge of perhaps being stopped and defeated. But now Russia is sending in reinforcements to help the rebels. Right? And according to one report here, evidence of a possible turn was seen in the panicky retreat of Ukrainian soldiers on Tuesday from a force they said had come over from the Russian border. So it turns into a certain amount of my dad can beat your dad up. The rebels beat the Ukrainian government, then the Ukrainian government beats the rebels, then the Russian soldiers come in to beat the Ukrainian government soldiers. We'll see how this ends, but we talked yesterday a little about this. This isn't going to end. The situation with Ukraine and Russia is not likely to end in the foreseeable future. And the reason we say that is because even if the Ukrainian government reestablishes control over the eastern Ukraine and what appear to be something like organized forces among the Ukrainian rebels are defeated and sent home, those forces aren't going to, just because they are defeated in their organized manifestation, it doesn't mean that they're going to just quit. There will probably be rebels, guerrillas, anti-government terrorists that will continue to plague the eastern Ukraine until the Ukrainian government is worn out and forced to just say, all right, fine, if you want to be part of Russia, be part of Russia. We never liked you people anyway. Get out of here. The Ukrainian government may establish control. They may install Ukrainian soldiers, but they will fight the Russian underground for perhaps a generation. It might be over much sooner than that, but they could, in theory, they could fight the Russian underground for a generation. And so when are we going to see an end to it? Not anytime soon. Yesterday we had an article about consumer confidence. According to one report, it's at the highest level it's been in 7 years. People are happy. They think everything's running fine. We talked about it a little bit and said, look, we had other reports that indicated there were problems. And the question becomes, what are people so confident about? Here's a second article that raises that same question. And this is from the Fiscal Times. The headline is, Why We're So Down in the Dumps About the Economy. Nearly 5 years after the recovery began, Americans in alarming numbers believe the Great Recession permanently damaged the economy and that many aspects of the lifestyle they once enjoyed, a good job, income security, and more, may never again be theirs. They see this as permanent. This isn't just a blip. They don't think we're going to make a recovery to a strong economy, a prosperous economy. People, a lot of people are just saying, look, this is the way it's going to be. You're going to live in smaller homes, smaller rooms, smaller cars, less vacations, less money, and they're probably correct. Even more troubling, Americans don't believe the economy has actually improved or will improve, despite nearly half a decade of job growth and declining unemployment rates since the recession officially ended in 2009. Well, it's nice to know that the recession has officially ended. Back 5 years ago. We haven't been in a recession for 5 years now. Because, and I know that must be so, because how do I know? The government tells me so. But I don't necessarily believe the government. I would argue that we have been in a steady state of recession since 2008. All right. Technically, I might be mistaken, but there's a fundamental reality to that. We've been in trouble now since 2008, and we haven't gotten out of that trouble. It may be that the government has prevented the trouble from becoming considerably worse, but they haven't solved the problem, and it doesn't look like they're going to. What are they going to do to save the economy? How are they going to save the economy as so long as industries have relocated overseas and taken jobs with them? How are they going to save the economy so long as they allow illegal aliens to pour into this country and take jobs for low wages and depress the wages for everybody else in this country? How are they going to save this economy? And the answer is they're not. And no one in Washington, to my knowledge, has a plan or a program where they can do so. And the article, we may talk about this article more tomorrow, get into it a little deeper, and just point out there's problems and problems and problems. And this isn't doom and gloom. This is just an objective assessment of the facts. You can't deal with a problem, can't solve a problem, can't cope with a problem unless you diagnose it correctly. I think this article offers some of that diagnosis, and we'll try to get to it tomorrow. We're going to take a break here in a moment, and when we return, my guest will be James Corbett from The Corbett Report. CORBETTREPORT.com, the CorbettReport.com. We'll be talking about different issues involving geopolitics, the economy, and I hope you'll all stay tuned. And we're going to take that break, and I'm Alfred Ask. We'll be back in just a moment.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. I guess James Corbett is here. James is the author of The Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. Corbett Report with 2 T's, 3 and if you count report, but 2 for Corbett, 1 for report. And I guess we could count the R's and the couple of other letters in there, but we're going to let that go. We'll save that for another time. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004, been there for 10 years. Corbett Report website started in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Hello, James.
Hello, hello, Albert. How are you doing?
Just fine.
I'm sorry, Albert. I called you Albert.
Yeah, you did. It's all right. I've been called a bunch of things, and that's not a serious
one. Being called
Albert instead of Alfred is not a serious one. Where are we going here? Let's start with Putin and Poroshenko talks end on a positive note, but without an agreement. And we talked about this a little bit last week, where Vladimir Putin from Russia and Poroshenko, I can't think of his name, can't think of his first name. In any case, the president of Ukraine, two of them met together. We anticipated last week that this might mark the beginning of the end for the conflict in the Ukraine. But as it turns out, apparently there was no agreement. Was this a bad situation? Did we get less than we might have hoped for, or is it pretty much business as usual?
First of all, it's Petro Poroshenko, and it's strange that I know that, but I don't know Alfred to ask. But yes,
technically, it's not actually that strange. I will give Mr. Poroshenko the nod that he certainly has a little more following than I do.
Well, he has an interesting name, at any rate, for us English speakers. But yeah, the question, did they accomplish more or less than what they were expected to? I think, given the circumstances in which they're meeting, any progress at all is a good sign. I mean, I think anyone with their head screwed on straight does want tensions to ease and does want this situation, wants everyone to step back from the brink, because obviously no one wants this to really spill into some sort of war scenario. So the fact that they're at least meeting in this, that they apparently made some progress towards an idea for a ceasefire plan is somewhat hopeful. But obviously, I mean, there's a lot more progress that needs to be made, and it's not being helped by the fact that now apparently Ukraine has captured some Russian paratroopers within their borders, and now there's apparently a new report coming out today of another incursion in southeastern Ukrainian territory. So there's definitely some mitigating factors that are going on here that might make it difficult for that type of ceasefire to be drawn out right now. But at any rate, again, as I say, any sort of progress towards a backing away from the military tension is progress that we have to applaud at this point.
Jane's Defense claims that Ukrainian military moves to endgame. That's the headline in a report on this. Ukrainian troops have continued their offensive aimed at clearing pro-Russian rebels from the Donetsk and Lugansk regions despite strong resistance. Both the Ukrainian and rebel forces are using tracked armor, heavy artillery, and rockets in the heaviest fighting seen in Europe since the Balkan conflicts of the 1990s. But this article alleges that the Ukrainian military is getting close to a victory. All right? That the end is near. That's the implication of the article. But there's another article out from another source that's saying, no, this thing is maybe going in the rebels' direction. Do we have any idea who's really winning, losing, or...
Well, I don't, at any rate. I don't have any direct sources of what's going on there in eastern Ukraine, and I'm not sure that I necessarily trust any one particular source that I see out there in the media, because, again, I mean, everyone's coming at this from an angle, and it's quite clear that a lot of the mainstream media in the West is on the side of Ukraine and wants this to be a Ukrainian victory. So perhaps, I mean, as we know, the reporting on how the war is progressing is always used as one psychological propaganda technique in the war itself, and it's always been so that in the depths of World War II at the beginning, I mean, they always reported on successes and never reported on losses, and it's the same thing, I think, in this situation. So it's always difficult to know these types of things unless you're talking with people there directly on the ground. It would be surprising to me if the Eastern Ukrainian separatist faction were able to decisively win this against the Ukrainian military. I mean, that would be, I think,
it looked like they could in the beginning, because the whoever they had to fight in the beginning had such poor morale and was so poorly organized that they were badly defeated by the rebels. But apparently they've sent in the first string, and now the rebels are having much more problem.
Right. I mean, but there's a difference between sort of militarily defeating an opponent and then actually successfully kind of occupying and administering a district. And when you talk about that, then you're talking about some sort of, you know, guerrilla type actions against an invading or occupying army. And that becomes a very different calculation. So I think militarily, I imagine the Ukraine probably does have the upper hand. But in terms of actually ruling over that population in Donetsk and Luhansk is very, 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 very much a different beast and very much more difficult to accomplish.
I think that's a good point. Right now, what we've seen was apparently one army versus another, even though the rebels' army was, you know, only casually organized. It wasn't so much a guerrilla operation as it might have been described as two military entities facing off against each other. Once the Ukrainian military, if they succeed in stopping the rebel military, the rebels are going to probably, are they going to just go back home and say, okay, that's it, we quit? Or how many of them will engage in guerrilla tactics after the Ukrainian military takes over eastern Ukraine? And how will they deal? How successfully will they deal with guerrilla warfare right there in their own country?
Right. I mean, exactly. That's the operative question. And yeah. How do you accomplish that? Because whatever the actual percentages of the population there in that eastern Ukrainian area that does desire separation, whatever percentage that might be, it certainly is a significant proportion of the population that really does feel themselves to be more Russian than Ukrainian and speak Russian in their daily language. And I think that, again, it's a question of how do you actually successfully administer and rule over an area like yeah. that? I mean, that tension is going to be there. And now that I think there's been this outright spilling over of tension, I don't think it's easy to put that toothpaste back in the tube. So, so again, it does become a very difficult thing. And of course, this is all complicated by the fact that there is a lucrative gas field there in eastern Ukraine that Royal Dutch Shell has invested into the tune of $10 billion. And that's not the type of investment that a company like Royal Dutch Shell can afford to just sneeze at. So, I mean, there's some significant resources here on the table, obviously, which complicates matters greatly. And this is, of course, why the Ukraine is prosecuting this militarily so hard, why they're so interested in the region, I think, not only to secure the tax base, but also, I mean, clearly there's resources there to be gained as well. And I think this is going to be a conflict that will not resolve nicely or neatly or in a nice little bow. I think there, whichever
quickly.
Way it goes, it's going to be a point of tension there.
The implication here is that this will not be resolved even if it were admitted that the Ukrainian military had won the conflict up until now. Even if they win, this is not over. This could drag on for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, a ceasefire is different than peace. And I think you only
exactly.
have to look at the Korean Peninsula to take
true.
A look at that.
The other point, we were talking earlier about how hard it is to get accurate information, and I'm sure you've heard the aphorism, the first casualty of war is the truth. All right, anytime you start a war, the truth goes out the window. Nobody knows what the truth is anymore. And who is telling the truth? Who would dare to tell the truth? Who even knows the truth? What have we got here? Here's something in another part of the world. Ex-banker named economy minister in last chance reshuffle. This is from the AFP, and it's François Hollande. On Tuesday, installed former banker and ally as an economy minister in the emergency reshuffle, seen as the last chance to haul France out of the biggest crisis of his presidency. What's going on in France? Is this a serious problem, really, or is this just hyped? Are there serious implications here, or is this just a small thing, relatively small thing that only involves France?
Well, I certainly think this is at the moment kind of an internal French issue, but I think it does speak to the broader conversation that's taking place in Europe right now over the best way to actually steer the economy. And of course, we've had this type of conversation playing out over the course of the last several years, talking about austerity and the ways forward in terms of actually stimulating the European economy. Now, I don't know the all of the details of this, but I do know that the former economy minister resigned his position after criticizing Hollande's economic policies, I believe, last weekend. And that prompted this new cabinet shift that's taking place right now. So apparently this new economy minister, Emmanuel Macron, is a former Rothschild banker and a Hollande economic advisor. So meet the old guard, same as the new guard. Meet the new guard, same as the old guard. It seems like deck chairs on the Titanic at this point. But it does show that there are at least differences within these ruling cliques as to the direction that they want to take the country in. But I, again, I'm not sure this will be very significant, even for the French themselves, in terms of where this ultimately leads the country, because I think Hollande is going to be Hollande, and I don't think that there's going to be a significant shift in economic strategy here.
How will this likely affect the European Union?
Again, I suppose this depends on if this has any effect whatsoever on the French economy, which I think will be the key indicator of whether this has any sort of broader European knock-on effects. But again, I mean, this is, as I say, part of the austerity debate, so I suppose it plays into that. But I think that the real issue and the real news for the Eurozone is Mario Draghi, who was really the star of Jackson Hole last week at the annual meeting of central bankers in Wyoming, where everyone was expecting or waiting and hanging on every word that Yellen was going to make about any indication she might give about Fed policy and whether they're going to start tightening some of their stimulus. But actually, it became Draghi who became the star by saying that he was prepared to use any tool in the toolbox, or whatever phrase he used, to help the spur the European economy as it's now languishing in the 0.3-0.4% growth rate range. And they're trying to obviously boost that. So apparently the markets are reading this as saying that the ECB is getting ready to launch its own round of quantitative easing. And so markets started to spike accordingly, and the euro started to drop accordingly. So I guess mission accomplished as far as Draghi is concerned. Again, all he has to do is say these magic words, not even to actually do anything, but just give the indication that he might do something and markets react. And this is the situation we've been in for a number of years. People might remember back in 2012, Draghi actually made a big deal about his so-called bazooka, where the European Union, the European Central Bank, sorry, was committing to unlimited bond purchases in order to underlie the markets and to keep interest rates down. And that's, again, it was really just the suggestion of that which caused a little rally in the euro at that eurozone at mm-hmm. that point. So so this continues to be the game that they're playing. And I think, again, if we're living in this reality where central bankers can merely mouth these words, these platitudes, and markets will react, it doesn't really matter to a large degree which particular puppet is sitting in which particular ministerial position in the French cabinet.
Well, you know, when you talk about a particular official, he mouths some words and they get a reaction out of the markets. How much difference is that from the same official, instead of mouthing words, issuing fiat currency? Spinning it out of thin air. In a sense, the fiat currency doesn't have much more tangible reality than his words. And yet they think they're going to get a positive reaction out of this. We're going to go into quantitative easing, perhaps, for Europe. Do they have reason to believe it'll work in Europe any better than it's worked here in the United States?
Well, if they have reason to believe that, I certainly don't know what those reasons might be. I mean, I don't see why economic reality would be different on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the one difference might be the dimension of the national debt. It might be that Europe can do a few things that the United States may not be able to do, simply because I don't believe Europe is anywhere near as deeply in debt as the United States government is. Am I mistaken in that?
You know, to be honest, I don't know the combined debt of the eurozone, but I think it is. I mean, you're right. It is a very different economic situation that the eurozone mm-hmm. is in than what the America is in. So, I mean, I suppose you could argue that the effects of something like a quantitative easing will be different in that part of the world. But as you say, I mean, it really is pretty much the equivalent of just mouthing words, just printing pieces of paper, or even less than that. Just printing.
It gets to be comical on one level.
It really,
you know,
is.
It's the sort of thing where you look at it and you say, holy mackerel, you know, the world is being moved and manipulated based on what? They figured out a way to make the donkey move where you don't even have to smack him on the butt with a whip. They have, you know, they are making the donkeys move as an act of will rather than some sort of a tangible force. We don't have to force the mules. We can just say a few words or issue a couple pieces of paper and
right. Well, I would just want to say I think the story of Rumpelstiltskin is meant metaphorically, obviously, but I think they do spin gold from straw. I think that's what central banking is all about. They spin something that we're supposed to believe is valuable from something that is completely, you know, ephemeral, intangible, completely useless. And that's the real secret of banking, is that it is just this magical process that only works because we believe in it. And once that rug is pulled out, I think the real, you know, magicians are exposed for what they are, which are just people sitting around talking.
Charlatans. The magicians, then you find out these guys don't have any magical powers. They're just charlatans. Let's take a break for another commercial and on for some more commercials. I'm Alfred Addis, here in Financial Survival with James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. Be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett. James is calling in from Japan, and that's part of the reason this next article may be. If you haven't seen this, this is an astonishing assertion, and I'll be curious if you think this is correct or not. It involves China just across the chunk of the ocean. I think you're just east of. You're just east of China, if I understand correctly. Here's the headline, and it's from The Sovereign Man. Well, China lost 55% of its rivers. And they include a reference to a report. It says, a study by China's Ministry of Water Resources found that approximately 55% of China's 50,000 rivers that existed in the 1990s have disappeared. Moreover, China is overexploiting its groundwater by 22 billion cubic meters per year, yet its per capita water consumption is less than one-third the global average. This is astounding data. That's words from Sovereign Man. Are you aware of that study, and does this surprise you, or are you already aware? What do you think?
Was this a recent study?
Yeah, apparently. The report was just in the Sovereign Man, a newsletter that comes out A guy by the name of Simon Black, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Simon and his work. He does good work. But this is a story that I've certainly seen this headline before. In fact, I just pulled one up on theatlantic.com from April of last year, 2013. And they were talking about the disappearance of more than 28,000 rivers at that point. So
that would be right. We're talking 55% of 50,000 rivers, according to this. And 28,000 fits in more or less with that with that number.
Exactly. I don't think this is a newly documented phenomenon, but it is a phenomenon that is taking place, and one that I suppose shouldn't be too surprising to any of us who know that the sort of wholesale, I don't know how to even describe it, raping and pillaging of the land in China there for the purposes of this industrial, you know, revolution that they've undergone, I suppose, in recent years. I think we all understand the sort of environmental destruction that's been going on there, and anyone who hasn't understood that probably hasn't visited China. It certainly has. It's been a sort of winner take all, completely take what you can, and who cares about the rest of the population mentality that's been going on there in China for decades now. And I think this is just the culmination of it. So I don't think it's really surprising to anyone who's been basically keeping track with what's going on there.
But it's still an astonishing idea that that half of the rivers in that country could disappear. That doesn't mean that they've been channeled underground or whatever, but they have simply siphoned the water off to use for agriculture, for whatever. And as a result, they've just dried up half the rivers in the country. They don't function any longer. What does that say about China's future prospects?
Well, I think it says that obviously what they are doing is not sustainable in the sense that it will come to an end. I mean, they can't continue doing this forever, but I think that's exactly why China is beginning the process of its own sort of outsourcing and offshoring of various industrial activities. So now China is increasingly looking to Africa to start basically an industrial manufacturing base for the little trinkets and gewgads, which are no longer profitable to create in China itself. I mean, the process of globalization doesn't really stop, I mean, until it's completely encircled the globe. And just because America has offshored much of its capacity to China doesn't mean that China isn't going to start offshoring its capacity to Africa now, which is exactly what's happening. So I think that this process, I mean, is probably going to start slowing down in the coming years as more of the industrial sort of manufacturing capacity of China itself is offshored. But it's still, I mean, obviously a huge concern for people in China, and this ties into the air pollution issues that they have and other such things. But interestingly, I mean, the water issue itself is one that's been identified by a number of people as sort of the meme that's going to take over from the climate change CO2 carbon dioxide meme in the near future from the UN environmental agencies, the UNEP and the UNDP and these other types of bodies, which are obviously always sort of trying to concentrate on whatever the next big panic that they can scare money up and resources and scare more power for the UN. This is going to be a meme that they're going to take on. So I think this is just fodder for that type of panic that they're trying to create. And of course, they're going to blame at least a portion of this on climate change rather than, I think, on the industrial uses and agricultural uses, which are the real, I think, culprits in this case.
Well, who are they going to blame the climate change on?
Well, you, of course.
Well, I understand that the United States is routinely brought in, but China itself, I mean, if they're going to claim climate change with the massive pollution they have in that country, it's going to be hard to sell the average Chinese citizen on the idea that China is completely innocent when it comes to climate change.
I think you're right. The China and some of the other developing countries are the big missing piece of this puzzle that a lot of these UN agencies don't want people to think about too deeply, because I think a lot of this is targeted at the already developed industrialized world. It's targeted at the US and Canada and England and Australia, and targeted at these economies specifically because this is a political stick that's being wielded to try to beat sovereignty out of these nations and beat submission into them. to some sort of global authority. And again, I mean, we can look at all sorts of different quotations, like the Club of Rome writing back in the 1990s about how they needed some sort of problem, some sort of disaster that would basically force people to turn to global government, and climate change fits that bill. So, I mean, I think this is part of an unfolding agenda, and the big missing piece of this is, well, I mean, clearly the biggest industrial polluters at this moment are places like China, but of course they don't want you to think too deeply about that. They want you to think more about, you know, what you're putting into your SUV is going to, you know, change the course of human civilization.
You know, it's one of the points in the article that says overexploiting groundwater by 22 billion cubic meters per year, yet it's per capita, talking about China's per capita water consumption is less than one-third of the global average. I don't know what the global average is, but I'll bet it's less than half of what we spend on average in the United States, and it might be a third. I don't know what the global average is for water usage, but China is only got a third of what the global average is. That probably translates where they are using perhaps 10% as much water per capita as we use in the United States of America. And they're going, and they can't sustain it. That's such, I don't know that my percentage is anywhere close to inaccurate. You can, you know, speculate and correct me, but just regardless, imagine living in a world where you had only 10% as much water as you have right now in this country.
So you're saying the ALS ice bucket challenge wouldn't be a popular thing in China?
Yeah, the ice might be popular. I don't know about the bucket. Yeah. There'll be plenty of people looking for ice before they're done. The other thing you mentioned that they're talking, they are making plans to move industry to Africa. That's probably a good idea from their perspective. But the article continues, says China has been acquiring land across Africa and South America. The goal is to increase China's food supply, reduce its dependence on U.S. grain imports, and reduce its domestic water demand. If they don't grow their own food, they don't need as much water over there. So if they can make arrangements with Africa, South America, to supply a lot of their food, it not only supplies food, it reduces their demand for water.
So, that's right. I mean, again, industrial and agricultural uses are the main uses for water. So obviously, the more of that that's offshore, the less is going to be needed. But then, of course, that just outsources the problem, as it were, to Africa. And I mean, eventually, the buck is going to stop somewhere. I mean, at some point,
like
globalization reaches its zenith.
Somebody's going to, all of a sudden, they're going to die in a drought.
Yeah, well,
it's like playing
somebody's
old bait. We'll just keep on passing this around until finally it can't go any further, and then a nation, a continent, is going to suffer something horrific. Here's an article from the New York Times. The headline is "Arab Nations Strike in Libya, Surprising U.S." Cairo twice in the last 7 days. Egypt and the United Arab Emirates have secretly launched airstrikes against Islamic allied militias battling for control of Tripoli, Libya, in a major escalation of regional power struggle. The United States, the officials said, was caught by surprise. Egypt and the Emirates, both close allies and military partners, acted without informing Washington, leaving the Obama administration on the sidelines. Is that oversight? Is the failure to notify Washington an oversight? Or is it evidence that we are increasingly the little man behind the curtain and they don't think they need to deal with us over there?
Very much the latter. And in fact, this is a story that I covered with James Evan Pilato in our latest New World Next Week video, which is just up on my website today. And absolutely, I think this is a sign of the declining, not the declining relevance, but the declining power of the United States geopolitically to act in various regions. And I think Zero Hedge had a very interesting post up on this where they note that it gets worse. Egyptian officials explicitly denied the operation to American diplomats, according to these officials.
Yeah.
It is almost as if the theme of ignoring and or mocking U.S. superpower status exhibited most recently by both China and Russia is gradually spreading to even the more banana republics around the world. And I think that is an astute observation. I really do think that there is this growing tendency to basically think, well, the U.S. is less relevant or less able to exert power. So why don't we act unilaterally just like they always have? And it's the hypocrisy of the United States trying to claiming to be furious about the unilateral bombing of a country is, pretty self-obvious, self-evident, including, in Libya itself, obviously.
Yeah, the article, here's another line from the article. It says, the strikes in Tripoli are another salvo in a power struggle defined by Arab autocrats battling Islamist movements seeking to overturn the old order. What they're implying here is that we're seeing a battle between the autocrats, which I can say are Muslim fascists. Now, some people might disagree with that description, but I'm going to use that just for sport. And the Muslim fascists that are in power and they want to keep their power are fighting the Muslim fanatics who are driven by their spirituality, perhaps, to fight the existing order. The question to you, who do you think is going to win, the fascists or the fanatics?
It will ultimately come down to who is better funded and equipped and who has the bigger base and infrastructure of support. I mean, clearly, I think within these populations, especially in Libya, which has been a non-fanatic driven population, a very secular Arab country for a very, very long time, I think that the support, the momentum is not behind the fanatics. But that, of course, raises the question, where do these extremists come from and how are they there and how are they gaining a foothold at all? And of course, again, that has to go back to the 2011 invasion, which was facilitated by the bringing in of all of these fanatics, these extremists from Iraq and from Syria and from these other places where they've also been stirring up problems in recent years. And I think this is just the circulation of these same fighting groups that, of course, always trace back to funding and financing and aid that come from Western intelligence quite explicitly. And we see that, I think, most explicitly in something like the Benghazi incident, where, of course, the real fire behind the smoke of Benghazi was the gun running that was being facilitated there at the U.S. mission there in Benghazi to Syria, and again, supplying the same types of Islamic extremists. So I think that there is a fundamental support that these groups are getting, and that's why groups like ISIS are popping up now all of a sudden and so well-funded and have such ability to act. It's because that there's obviously something behind them supporting them. And I think that this is part of that divide and rule strategy that's been applied in the region that we've talked about here in recent weeks. And I think this is just the culmination of that in Libya. And again, as we've talked about before as well, the chaos itself is a type of strategy rather than just a midpoint towards some end goal. As long as Libya itself is taken off the table politically, you don't have to worry about a Gaddafi coming along and threatening to go to a gold-backed currency or threatening to upset the balance of power in North Africa. So
I observed this over the years. You can do a bunch of things that a lot of people think are dangerous, but you mess with the money system and you'd better plan on going to the next world because they'll get you for it. We're out of time, James. Why don't you give folks a quick idea of where your contact, where you can be reached, where your website is, and where they can see your videos.
CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com, as you so well belabored at the beginning of this interview. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And that's where you can find all of my work and links to everything else that I do. So it's the one-stop shop.
All right, James, thanks very much for your time. Look forward to talking to you again next week. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. We are done, and I want to thank all of you for listening. And may the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night, folks.
I work all night. I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Got me a well-being.
money, money, always sunny.